In this Friday edition, we find out about the Redbud Resource Group, located in Fulton, California. We speak with Taylor Pennywell, Taimadu Nation, Berry Creek Rancheria, she is the executive director, and Rose Hammock, Madu Wailaki Pomo, she is in charge of communications and outreach. We hear how and why the Redbud Resource Group was created, what they are accomplishing, and what else do they want to take on.
Well, thanks so much for inviting us and reaching out to us. It's really nice to meet you. My name's Taylor. I'm changing my name. There you go.
Hi, I'm Rose.
Hello, Rose. Hello, Taylor.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Been a long time. I've been trying to get a hold of Redbud Resource Group for a while now. So I always understood there's just a couple of you, and I'm like, okay, you're busy. Yeah, all right. Yeah, I can understand that. There's only three of us here, or four of us. So I know how that goes.
But I'm glad that we were able to connect.
Yeah. Okay. So how'd you get started? Why'd you get started? Who came with this up with this idea?
Well, my name is Taylor Pennywell, and I'm the executive director of Redbud Resource Group. And I'm also Time Maidu from Berry Creek Rancheria up in Butte County, California, in Orville. And I'm also a teacher by trade. So I have a master's in education, and I worked in education for 7 years in San Francisco. And when I was working in San Francisco, I noticed that our native students were really struggling to find a place in school, to feel belonging. And it was also very clear that our curriculum completely erased our existence. And not only that, but within the staff of the school, really amazing teachers, well-meaning people, forward-thinking people, our staff didn't really recognize that our native students existed either. And this was resulting in, you know, all the usual disparities that we're used to, high dropout rates, truancy rates, low, you know, kids not engaging with the material. But we also know that this is linked to high suicide rates that we have in our youth, right, is that our kids don't feel belonging in school. And so I had a conversation with a boss of mine. This boss asked me, you know, what's your long-term goal for teaching? What do you want to be? Do you want to be a teacher forever? You know, what's your plan? And I said, well, eventually I want to go and I just want to serve Native kids. And I want to work on Native focused curriculum. And she said, that is so noble. That is such a good idea. Too bad we don't have any Native kids in this school. And of course, I had already figured out that I had 5 Native kids in my classroom from local tribes that year that I've been developing relationships with. And so my response to her was, it's not that we don't have Native kids here, it's that you don't see them. You fundamentally don't recognize their existence. At the same time, my cousin Madison, who's also from member of Berry Creek, working at the NIH, doing medical research and getting her public health degree at Harvard. So like big institutions with a lot of power. And she was having the same issue. Native people weren't represented in the public health data. She turned in a report to her professor at Harvard. The report was designing a public health intervention to address high maternal mortality rates in the Boston Native community. And she had spent, you know, months working with that community, going to Indian Health to design this intervention. And when she got the report back from her professor, it had a big F on it. The reason for that F was that the Native community didn't represent a large enough population for it to be worth it to design the intervention. It cost too much money. Response wouldn't be significant enough. And so we kind of realized that this systematic erasure of Native people is happening in so many different fields. And it's happening by the experts, by the people who are in positions of power in this country. Our educators, our policymakers, our medical researchers, our public health institutions, our professors at major universities. And so this light bulb went off and we were like, well, how do we fix this? Like, who is going to intervene? And the reality is that the only people who can really intervene in this persistent erasure are Native people. We design the best interventions. we design the best programs to combat erasure and to create more visibility of our people. And so we made Redbud Resource Group as her public health master's program project with Harvard. And I think Harvard felt kind of bad about that F, and they gave us a little bit of seed funding to get started. And so we ended up partnering with California Indian Museum and Cultural Center here in Sonoma County to do a series of local native place-based science curriculums. So we have a curriculum that's designed for like 7th grade to 12th grade called Healthy Ecosystems Feed Healthy Communities that celebrates traditional ecological knowledge in the Oak Woodlands ecosystem here in Sonoma County and connects TEK to nutrition. So the idea is that when we're in better relationship with our environment, that we also are in better relationship with our bodies, because our environment is able to provide clean water, healthy foods, nutritional medicines for us, and vice versa, right? When we care for the environment, it can produce those things. And so there's a reciprocal relationship. And so that was one of our curriculums that we did. But, and I know this is long, so I'm going to wrap it up, but our two other programs that we have right now are one, Going Beyond Land Acknowledgements, which is a 6-part training program designed to help non-Native organizations and agencies return land, power, and resources back to Native communities with a really big focus on sovereignty strengthening. And then our long-term plan is to build out a public health wing that is doing similar work, but in the public health sector. And so that's a little bit of our story. We've existed since 2020, June, so not very long, but we have a really dynamite group of Native women here who are really hard workers and are, you know, just, I feel really grounded and guided by our ancestors to do this work. And so failure isn't even on the table. We're just going to keep going.
Very good. Thank you very much. Yeah, and that's how you got started, huh? You got a failing grade. So a lot of success comes out of failure, you know.
That's right.
Very good. How about you, Rose?
Okay. So I have been with Redbud a little bit over a year. Before working for Redbud, I spent about 5.5 years working for one of our local tribes here in Sonoma County, Figure, which is the Federated Indians of Great and Rancheria. They are Southern Pomo and Coast Miwok, and living here in Santa Rosa, that's our most closest tribe. And so I worked in their TANF department, and I worked with Native youth. So Great Inn serves many of their own tribal members as well as surrounding tribes, mostly here in Sonoma County. So we got opportunities to work with the kids on the school side of things, so helping with homework and different things like that. But for myself, I really got a chance to bring more of the culture to the kids that wanted to know more about their culture. I'm Pomo and Wailaki Maidu, but I have the closest connections to my Pomo ancestry that comes from Lake of Mendocino County. I'm enrolled in Round Valley Indian tribes. And so my family's Pomo and Wailaki from there up in Mendocino County. And a lot of what I do is beading and basketry and things like that. And so I take those things that I do in my own life and my own family and made sure I was making time for the kids to find those connections to the culture, because that supported them, that this wasn't just a regular, oh, after school program. Like, yeah, you could go and do what kids like to do, go run outside or make slime and things like that. But really, a lot of the kids were drawn to learn how to make clapper sticks, which we use in our ceremony, and learning how to make beadwork, learning about different styles of basketry and different techniques, and just learning about the plants and learning about the animals, and really helping guide the children to know the resiliency that we come from, you know, and the greatness that we come from, and sharing stories about, you know, the elders in our family and why it's so important to maintain good relationships with our elders. And so I bring all of that to Redbud in helping develop curriculum and help facilitate our program for Going Beyond Land Acknowledgements, and also just utilizing the relationships Taylor and I have made here in Sonoma County. We both live here. We actually live really close to each other. You know, it's important for us to attend local community events, and it's beyond just serving our community. It's really building those long-lasting relationships and hearing what the community needs and how we can use our resources and use what we have and what we can do to best serve the people that are here. Because like we say in many of our trainings, although we're Native, we're still guests where we live here. And so we try to do our best to make sure that we're serving the people with the best intentions and the best way we can.
Very good. Thank you. A little background on me. I kind of backed into this radio business. I never thought I'd be operating a radio station. The value of Native media. You talk about Native education and awareness. We don't have enough radio stations. I think that right along with the education, that media in any form of it today should also have the support of Congress. Taylor Pennywell.
That's such a good idea. And it is really, the need for that is really underscored by the natural disasters and massive fires that we're having, is the need to be able to communicate and to get our people to safety, right? And get interventions to our people, get water, get food. And now up in Berry Creek, we had the North Complex fire that blew right through the whole mountain. Our whole tribal territory was decimated in 2020, and it was hard to get a hold of people. I mean, I could see how a tribal radio would have been essential for something like that.
Oh, yeah. That's when people tune us in.
Absolutely.
All you need is a transistor radio. And if you have a landline telephone, you can call us and we can say you need help or something. And yeah, we're the lifeline.
But I'll also just say that, like, media is also a huge education tool.
Absolutely.
Right. It's a part of education infrastructure. What I found as we started doing our curriculums is that we don't have a lot of Native made media that we can use as tools in lesson plans. Right. And so I'm writing a lesson plan and I'm thinking, like, well, I really want a case study from a tribe that will engage kids and that will show them something amazing that a tribe is doing, whether it's a radio show, whether it's photography, whether it's a short film, whether it's a short story or an article, right? I need something that is made by our people that is highlighting the strengths of our people or the infrastructure of our people or the whatever, tell the stories of our people in order to have an authentic voice in the curriculum. You can't have a Native curriculum and not have Native voices in it. And that really highlights the need for Native people to learn how to make media. We recently received a grant to go on a land back tour of the state to bring a camera, and we come out with our group of women and interviews about different land back processes that are in process or that have been successful in the state, to show our students, but also show other tribes and non-Native landowners what land back can look like and what the methods and options are that they have for engaging in the process. And the reason that we thought about that is exactly what you said, is like, if you don't have the media and it's not coming from Native people, then the opportunity to educate is kind of missing. Those case studies need to be made so that we push these processes through.
When does this happen?
We just started. So in March, we went to Concow Valley Band of Maidu Indians, and that's their my tribal neighbors up in Butte County. We worked with them for 2 days to interview them about their land back. They recently got 10 acres of their land back, and they previously were a landless, non-recognized tribe in the state of California. And so for them to get this land back, it's kind of sparking all these new opportunities within the tribe, because people are learning about their tribal monitoring services. Many of their children have never been to their ancestral land because they didn't have access to it. And so we were able to record the first experience that many of these children had stepping foot on their land. And you could see the change that was happening, pride, the interest, that was being sparked by getting access to that place. And so they were our first case study, and we're hoping to have it released at the end of the summer, but we are looking for other people who would like to have their tribe, we'd say celebrated, really. It's a celebration, and to let us partner to create a piece of media that can, you know, can serve as that celebration.
You know, Kayleen Sisk in her efforts?
Yes, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
KALW in San Francisco is working on a series of podcasts. I've got a lot of material already done. They invited me to be one of their producers, and I said, I can't dedicate the time that you need. So they got other people, but they put me on the advisory council.
It takes a lot of work. I mean, we are making it up as we go. Good for us to know what already exists and what our elders, like what work people have been putting in for decades, because we're not making this up out of thin air. We're building upon things that already exist that have been laid out for us. And so any way that we could get access to resources that you've worked on that you would like us to help bring into this conversation, happy to do that. If there's podcasts that already exist that we should be spreading around with people.
This is the Friday edition. Our guests are Taylor Pennywell and Rose Hammock of the Red Bud Resource Group, a California Native advocacy group.
I get involved with consensus building. It's a skill that I'm trying to grasp, you know, going way back in our memories. And we did this before we had majority rule type of stuff. So in these sessions that I'm the only person of color, I always pick up this land acknowledgement statement of these people. And then I come across Redbud Resource Group, and you had this beyond land acknowledgement. I said, hey, you people, you need to check into this thing. So I wondered, who are the people who do come to you, and why do they come to you, and what do you share with them?
Taylor Pennywell.
It's a great question. Rose, you want to take that one?
Rose Hammock.
I'll give it a crack. All right. So for what we like to call our clients, the people that we work with, so far we've had a mixture of conservationists, conservation groups. I think something important that a lot of these conservationists don't really visualize or maybe understand is that a lot of the times they have access to land trust and parcels of land, and they're conservationists, so they're doing, you know, maybe water management, or they're working in different waterways, they're working with creating or developing things on that parcel of land, but they're not aware of that there are Native people in that area of where they operate. And some of the lands that belong to these conservation groups is really should be the local tribe's land, and they should be the ones that have the access to that land. And so a real big push eventually with, you know, our programming is to get them to understand that as non-Native people, it's important to either lean into co-management, where you're allowing those people to come in and be able to have a say-so in what's going on. But essentially, we want land returned back to our local tribes, and we want to see the local people going back to their land, just like what we got to see in Kunkel, bringing families together, having the youth, the elders, everyone in between, sharing food, sharing song, sharing prayer, being in that place in a good way. Because, you know, a lot of these groups so far have really been in, I feel, the right, they have the right heart for it. You know, they want to be in good relations, and they want to make sure they're doing the right thing, but they don't quite have all the tools there yet. And so we really help support them, kind of our overview, our scope of, well, all of these organizations in California, you need to understand California Native history. You need to understand all of the genocide and things that have happened through our lens, through what happened to us and our people, because it's really us kind of giving them some context to what has happened here. And then we move into all these other different parts of our program. I feel we do a good job at not necessarily pointing the finger and pointing out all the wrong things or the things that are not negative, but things that they need to improve on. We also point out the good things that they do already and say, well, here's the good things you got, and here's some things that need a little work, and really helping them have the tools to know how to address our tribal leaders and address the tribes and address people in the community. We encourage them to go to community events just to build those relationships. That way, you know, we're not here for the long haul as far as every time you talk to a Native person, we're going to be there to support you. It's not like that. We want to make sure that they have all the right tools to really know how to build those good relationships on their own.
Yeah.
Taylor Pennywell.
So something we introduced in the very first session, because it's six sessions, is we made kind of an allyship spectrum. And it's a spectrum of impact that your actions could have on a Native community. And the very bottom is enabling erasure. And we have people brainstorm, like, what are all the things that you could do in your organization, in your life, that would actually erase the humanity of Native people? And so it's the obvious stuff, right? Like Halloween costumes, cultural appropriation, not inviting Native people to the table, taking land, et cetera. European place names, Western place names, the obvious things. And then the one right above that is first steps to recognition. And that's where land acknowledgements go, because it's really, I always say people, I'm like, it's one step above racism. Like, you're still pretty far down the spectrum, just acknowledging someone's existence. And then the next one is about educating others, right? Taking the basic knowledge that you have of the existence of Native people and Indigenous environments and relationships and spreading them with your community. And then the one above it is impactful action. And those are actions that are directly related to strengthening sovereignty, land return, resource return, et cetera. And we have people brainstorm all the things that you might be doing in your life or your work that would fit under that. And so people leave the first session realizing that the land acknowledgement is very low on what you could do. It's a basic step, but they also start to realize that there are many big actions that you can take, land back, but there are also a lot of smaller actions that could be easy to implement, that you can implement immediately in your life or your organization, that don't require you to have a complete systemic overhaul yet. Because we also realize that that level of overhaul takes time. You don't get decolonized in 90 minutes. You know what I mean? Though people would love that. And so we start with that and make sure everyone gets that immediately. Because what one thing that we hear a lot is that people are so scared to either do a land acknowledgement, they're so scared to go beyond a land acknowledgement that they just do nothing. And we also hear people saying, well, I don't want to give a land acknowledgement or go beyond it until I've checked every box, right? Like, I want to have this perfect vision of who I am as an ally to Native people before I even do anything. And our response is like, we don't really have time for you to feel perfect. We need you to do something now. And so identify things in your life, in your work that you could do now, knowing that you're going to continue to educate and mess up and learn and build towards something bigger, which for us is a complete return of Indigenous sovereignty. We are very clear about our bias there. But we've seen some really good things happen. And I would say that one of the biggest, we have seen an increase in conversations about land return within the conservation world. We have seen, I would say almost everyone that we've worked with has added Native sovereignty or some form of that into their strategic plans of their organization. And the reason that we really push that is because we want the commitment to sovereignty to be codified in something. Because we know that people say they want to do this all the time, but they need something that's going to hold them accountable. And so we say, like, you need to figure out what you're going to do and put it in your plan. We just had a meeting today with one of our people that we've been working with, And they've decided that they're going to set up within their organization. It's a big environmental organization in the state that they're going to set up a massive multi-$1,000s fund that's going to go directly to Native people. And that came out of a conversation that we had with them about their need to provide direct support as opposed to supporting like non-Native organizations who can then go out and give charity work to us, right? Like the money just needs to go to us. And so they've created that. We are seeing shifts in mindsets and paradigms, but it's not just in people's brains. It's like getting put into their actual concrete plans and actions. And I believe that there are many organizations across the state and country who want to be there. They just, to lack of a better phrase, like need a little bit of handholding, and they need to have some of the basic concepts of sovereignty explained to them because they simply don't know. So that's just a couple examples. We will also say like long-term, right now this program is serving mostly non-Native audiences, but our long-term plan is to, not even long-term, mid-term plan within a year or two, we want to redesign the program to be designed for Native people. Because we also realize that we've gotten all of these organizations to commit to Native sovereignty, but our communities have a limited capacity to answer the call. And so we're now realizing like we need to be putting even more work into our own communities and giving them a version of this program that's going to make our people feel really confident advocating for themselves. And when someone comes to them from one of these orgs and says like, well, we have $100,000 we want to give you, and our people say, absolutely, we're confident taking it. We know that we can manage this and create a strong, sustainable future for our descendants.
You know, like it goes right along with our ceremonies, you know, to heal the world. Well, in that process, we have to heal ourselves. Otherwise, we can't heal the world.
Yeah, I often say that in a lot of ways for me personally, that Redbud is actually a grief project because it was born from grief, not only the grief of understanding that like systematically we don't exist in the eyes of many people who have power over us, but also because my grandmother, right, when we started Redbud, my grandmother died of brain cancer. And this is my Maidu grandmother and was really my connection to culture, like many of our grandmothers are. And I'm Maidu through my maternal line, and that's really, really strong. And when she passed, it was like this, it was, I kind of say it's like a symbolic passing of the baton. You know, that I think a lot of young Native people and just a lot of Native people in general feel when our elders pass is we now have this responsibility. It's now on us to decide what we are going to do with everything that we have learned from our ancestors. How are we going to use that? What are we going to channel the grief into that could be good? And that's why when I say like our work at Redbud cannot fail, that's actually why, is because it is completely born of the strength of our past relatives, but it's also like being driven by grief and like a need to do something with it that's productive. And I hope that, I think that resonates with people, but I also hope that we can give other Native people a space to communicate that and exercise it in a way that can bring healing to ourselves into our ecosystems, our Indigenous ecosystems.
We thank our guests for the advocacy work they are doing. We wish them well. The Friday Edition is a production of Hoopa Tribal Radio, Hoopa, California. The producer, host, and engineer has been Joseph Orozco, lead producer. You could visit our guest organization at www.redbudresourcegroup.org. That's www.redbudresourcegroup.org. We thank you for listening.